Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Chris Babbitts. Today's guest is Donna Drucker, the author of Contraception, A Concise History, published by the MIT Press. In Contraception, Dr. Drucker covers the development, manufacturing, and use of contraceptive methods from the late 19th century to the present. Importantly, she does so from the perspective of reproductive justice. Thank you so much for being with us, Donna.
Thank you for asking. It's great to be with you.
To get things started, could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, sure. Since September of 2016, I've worked as the senior advisor for English as a language of instruction at Darmstadt Technical University in Germany. I'm also the author of two other books, one called The Classification of Sex, which is about Alfred Kinsey and the Kinsey Reports, and the other one is called The Machines of Sex Research, which is about, you guessed it, machines used in human sex research.
So fascinating. You identify the opening of Aletta Jacob's birth control clinic as the beginning of the modern contraceptive era. What was it about Jacob's Amsterdam clinic that marked something different from the past?
Yeah, Aletta Jacob's opened a birth control clinic in Amsterdam in 1882. And it was really the first time that a woman could get a woman-controlled contraceptive on her own without her husband's or a male relative's permission. Women could get them individually from doctors, here and there, usually from a man called Dr. Menzinga, who was active in Germany, and that's where Aletta Jacobs first got her diaphragms. But Jacobs's clinic was the first time a woman physician opened a clinic for women patients to get woman-controlled contraceptives on their own.
She also seemed to have provided some influence for women around the world who were seeking these methods. Could you talk a little bit about how people look towards Jacobs as inspiration?
Sure. Yeah, Jacobs's clinic was active for 12 years Jacobs's clinic was active for about 12 years from 1882 to 1894. And she really wasn't active in the birth control movement in the Netherlands for about 20 years until Margaret Sanger enters the picture and really enters Jacobs's clinic to the history books. Sanger leaves the United States in 1914, comes to Amsterdam early in 1915, and she knew that Jacobs had opened the first birth control clinic in Amsterdam and wanted to learn how to fit diaphragms herself from Jacobs. And so Jacobs refused to see her because Sanger was not a licensed physician. Sanger ends up learning how to fit diaphragms from one of Jacobs's colleagues. But that's really where Jacobs comes into the historical narrative of birth control, is through Sanger's contacting her. And people look to Jacobs's clinic and Jacobs herself, not only as a birth control advocate and a site for birth control, the beginning of birth control politics, but also as part of Jacobs's efforts for world peace and the women's peace movement, which she was involved in for the rest of her life after the clinic closed.
You've already mentioned diaphragms, but what contraceptive methods have had staying power over the years?
Perhaps the method with the longest staying power historically has been abstinence, which is, of course, just the not perhaps refusal or denial of your sexual desires and decision not to have sex at all. Also, we can look at timing methods. We can look at withdrawal, which is, of course, when a man withdraws his penis from a woman's vagina at the point of orgasm, hoping not to leave any sperm inside. But, of course, that's a very tricky method to get right. And it's also not always clear if it's been effective. We can also look at timing methods regarding a woman's period, which were not very accurate considering it wasn't widely known when exactly women ovulated until 1929. So any timing advice you might read before 1929 is pure guesswork. Also, barrier methods for men have had a very long history back as far as the 18th century, often made of animal skin, fish skin, rubber, and later latex. Condoms for men have been a perpetual part of contraceptive history. And I should make a note that when I say men, or I usually mean in the past, people who are anatomically recognized as men or were given or identified male at birth. I know that is not always true, but if someone identified historically as male, I refer to them as male.
How did the development of hormonal contraception change how people thought about their bodies, sexualities, erotic relationships, and reproduction?
There are a number of pluses and minuses with the development of hormonal birth control in the mid-1950s. Some of the positives were that it was hidden. A woman could take the pill or later hormones in other forms without a partner's knowledge. So if perhaps she was in an abusive or coercive relationship, she could limit pregnancy without a partner knowing. Secondly, the birth control pill also separates the physical device from the act of sex. So there's no loss of spontaneity, which is something that sex advice writers up until the pill are very attentive to, that putting on the condom or putting in a diaphragm lessens intimacy and it interferes with spontaneity. So having a pill does not interfere at all with kind of arousal and an intercourse or other sex acts to follow. It also later on, as we move into the 80s, 1980s and 1990s, it's available in different forms. In addition to the pills, such as the shot and the patch and the ring. And so if with some forms of birth control, you can have a shot or you can put on a patch, leave it on for 2 or 3 months, and then not even think about it, not having to take anything daily and just getting the patch, renewed every few months or so. On the downside, especially at first, but still today, there tend to be side effects depending on what formulation of the pill or of the hormonal method that one uses. These include high blood pressure, susceptibility to weight gain, an increase in the possibility of strokes, moodiness, and somewhat ironically, a lack of desire or a loss of desire.
How do you define reproductive justice in the book, and how does this concept relate to the history of contraception?
That's a great question. Reproductive justice is a concept that emerged in the early 1990s, primarily with organizations of African-American women. And they eventually came to a framework that helps reproductive rights and justice activists act and organize today. And it has three seemingly simple but actually complex points, which are first the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, and third, the right to parent in a healthy environment. And they tend to use the word framework when discussing reproductive justice, as it is indeed a framework for studying and analyzing different phenomenon, usually related to public policy and the execution of policy. And it also provides inspiration and for organizing and activism that provides a synthetic perspective on reproductive justice for everyone. For example, following the reproductive justice framework, women's groups may organize around a sterilization abuse, for example, as part of fighting against, for fighting for the right to have a child. But on the other hand, other groups, or even perhaps the same group, might at the same time fight for the right to abortion, which is, of course, the right not to have a child. And these ideas are based in the Declaration of Human Rights, of course, promulgated in December of 1948. And so they have the basic foundation of that a human being has the right to control what happens to their body. So it's really not framed around rights, like my right to act or my right not to act, but really has a deeper roots in this global, universally accepted, if not universally followed, framework of the Declaration of Human Rights. And so how it relates to contraception falls under really those first two categories, the right to have a child and the right not to have a child. And access to contraception and also to abortion kind of falls under that second point of reproductive justice. But also the right to say no to contraception and the right to have a child, or what the Declaration of Human Rights calls the right to form a family. The first point is important as well. So we can use the reproductive justice framework to analyze when contraception is not available to people, or when it's being used against people, against their will, and really to see it as access to it in all its forms as part of, in a fundamental level, the right of a human being to determine whether or not they have a child.
I think one of the most fascinating parts of your book was how you cover the vanguard movement of women of color for the reproductive justice movement and the framework. Why have they critiqued versions of white feminism? In what ways have women of color pushed the movement for reproductive justice in new and vital directions?
Right, that's a great, really great question. Women of color really start to criticize groups that focus on women's reproductive rights, kind of starting in the 1960s, but more heavily in the 70s and 80s, because a lot of groups in the U.S. that focus on reproductive rights and access are focused on abortion rights and access with and a lesser extent, but an important extent, access to birth control and general reproductive health care. And what that perspective leaves out, of course, is the fact that many women of color, particularly Native American women, Latina women, African American women, were subject to sterilization abuse by federal and state agencies who thought that they were not fit to reproduce, an idea that goes way back in time, even to the mid-18th century, but is circling around the U.S. health policy in starker detail from the 1920s forward. So for a woman of color who sees a women's group focused only on abortion, might see that focus really as ignoring kind of the second or the first part of the reproductive justice framework, is just the right to have a child, which was often denied to women who, for example, might be involuntarily sterilized on a Indian or Native American reservation in the 1930s or 1940s, if a white physician thought that that woman had had, quote unquote, enough children. So what we see happening, particularly in the early 1990s onward, is women of color organizing both within their ethnic groups to target specific issues important to African American women and Native American women, Latina women, but also looking at ways that looking at what these groups have in common regarding women of color's reproductive rights and agency generally. So what you see is people working both on individual ethnic group issues, but also kind of in a pan woman of color organizational framework, which is really inspiring and hopefully inspires a lot of other people to get involved as well.
I learned a lot in your last chapter, which touches on contraceptive concerns of approximately 225 million people throughout the world for whom contraceptive methods are inadequate or current contraceptive methods are inadequate. Could you talk about the very valid concerns that some of this large and diverse segment of the population have with available contraception?
That's a great question. The lack of access to contraception and to reproductive health care services, sexual health care services, is an ongoing problem, of course, for over 200 million individuals throughout the world. These problems include contraceptives being too expensive, not having the right type of contraception for someone's needs. For example, if they can't take a hormonal method, they want to use a different one, and perhaps a female condom simply isn't available. Contraceptives can be forbidden by states. So if a state wants to encourage its population to reproduce, it might restrict the availability of contraceptives or even contraceptive information if they want to promote pregnancies and births. Also kind of on a more intimate or personal level, there may be pressure by partners either to use or not to use contraceptives that go against what the person who would become pregnant's views on reproducing are. The other problem that we can see, which in United States slang is called stealthing, is a form of kind of reproductive abuse, really, in which a partner tells another that they are using contraceptives, but when in fact they aren't, or they remove a condom, for example, during sex without the other person's knowledge. And so the person who could get pregnant's right to choose pregnancy or not is really taken away. So we can see a lack of access kind of on a personal, intimate level, kind of on a local level where people can't always get the devices or information that they need, and also on a national level, where national governments may not make contraceptives available. So it's a multi-layer problem.
Do you have any predictions about what contraception might look like in the future?
I think it will probably be development on both the two major areas of contraception, which are chemical or hormonal contraceptives, and on the other side, which are barrier or behavioral method. I'll start the future part over again. There will be likely developments in the future of contraception along two lines. The first is along the chemical or hormonal line, and the second is on the barrier or physical method or behavioral line. And so in the 2000s, we saw further work on the development of a hormonal method for men, which did not work because the World Health Organization pulled the study due to complaints by the participants about hormonal side effects. And I think we'll also see development of other kinds of perhaps barrier methods, perhaps something related to blocking methods for sperm that don't necessarily cover the whole penis, but might be available to people who aren't worried also about STIs, for example, internal sperm blockers that are physical, like they're gels and like a physical, small physical objects that would block sperm. But if the history of contraception is any guide, there will be a continuing innovation in this area. And one last point I would say is that there will likely be additional development of specific contraceptives for transgender individuals, both people who were assigned female at birth, people assigned male at birth. Again, both along the hormonal line and on the physical barrier line.
Donna, it has been great getting to chat about contraception. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
And for everyone else, head to the MIT Press website to purchase a copy of Donna's Contraception. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today at New Books Network. I'm Chris Babbitts, wishing you the best as you engage with cutting-edge works of history.